captive against whom his father cried aloud, and to this captain of whom his father boasted. All the time the two had talked, the old man seemed not at ease with Yuen, and he kept beginning little courtesies, such as one does to a guest and not to a nephew, and he fumbled at his teapot on a little table there beside him, making as though to pour tea for Yuen until Yuen stopped him, and he fumbled in his bosom for his pipe for Yuen to smoke, until at last Yuen perceived that, indeed, his uncle felt him like a guest, staring at him with troubled old eyes. And at last the old man said, "You look like a foreigner somehow. Your clothes and how you walk and move make you look foreign to me." Now though Yuen laughed, he was not overpleased at this, and a constraint came on him, since after all he could not answer it. And very soon, even though he had been 6 years away, he knew he had nothing to say to this old man, nor this old man to him, and so he took his leave. Once he looked back, but his uncle had forgotten him. He had settled himself in sleep, his jaws moving a little and then dropping open and his eyes closing. Even as Yuen looked at him, he was asleep, for a fly settled on his cheekbone while the maid stared at Yuen's foreignness and forgot to wave her fan, and it wandered down to his old hanging lips, and the old man did not move. When Yuen had left him thus, he went in search of his aunt, to whom also he must pay his respects. And while he waited, he sat in the guest hall and looked about him. Since he had returned, he found himself measuring everything he saw in new ways. And always, although he did not know it, the standard by which he measured was what he had seen in the foreign country. He was very well content with this room, which it seemed to him was finer than anything he had seen anywhere. Upon the floor was a large carpet covered with beasts and flowers in a very rich confusion, red and yellow and blue together. And on the walls were foreign pictures of sunny mountains and blue waters, all set in bright gold frames. And at the windows were heavy curtains of red velvet, and the chairs were all alike, red, very deep and soft to sit upon. And there were little tables of fine black carven wood set about here and there, and the very spittoons were not a common sort, but were covered with bright blue painted birds and gold flowers. At the farther end of the room, between the windows, there were hung four scrolls painted for the four seasons: red plum blossoms for spring, white lilies for summer, golden chrysanthemums for autumn, and the scarlet berries of heavenly bamboo lying under snow for the winter. To Yuen this seemed the gayest, richest room he had ever seen, full enough of things to amuse a guest for hours, for on every table were set little carven images and toys of ivory and silver. It was far more to see than that distant, worn, brown room he had thought warm and friendly for a while. He walked about, waiting for the maidservant to return and tell him he might go in, and while he waited a roar of a vehicle stopped at the doors, and his cousin and his wife came. Both these two looked prosperous beyond anything Yuen had remembered. The man was in his middle years and gaining all his father's flesh, and he looked even fatter than he was, since he wore the foreign dress, which hid nothing of his shape. And above its severity, which shaped clear his large belly, his round, smooth face was like a ripe yellow melon, for against the heat he had shaved away even his hair. Now he came in mopping the sweat from himself, and when he turned to give his straw hat to a servant, Yuen saw his neck in three great rolls of flesh beneath his shaven crown. But his wife was exquisite. She was no longer young, and she had had five children, but none would know it, since after every childbirth, as the custom was with such ladies of fashion in the city, she gave her child to some poor woman to be nursed, and she bound her breasts and body back again into slenderness. Now Yuen saw her slender as a virgin, and though she was 40 years of age, her face was pink and ivory, her hair smooth and black, her whole look untouched by any care or age. Nor did the heat touch her. She came slowly forward, greeting Yuen prettily and gravely, and only in the quick look of distaste which she cast at her huge, sweating husband could Yuen see the petulance she used to have. But she was courteous to Yuen, for she looked on him no longer as a raw youth from the small old home city, and only a child in the family. He was a man now, who had been abroad, and he had won a foreign degree, and he saw it matter to her what he thought of her. Then, to while the time away when they were seated after courtesies, and his cousin had shouted for tea to be brought, Yuan asked, "What do you now, elder cousin? For I see your fortunes have risen." At this the man laughed and was well pleased, and he fumbled at a thick gold chain hung across his great belly, and he answered, "I am a vice-president of a newly opened bank now, Yuan. There is good business these days in banks in this foreign place where wars cannot touch us, and they have opened everywhere. People used to put their silver into land. I remember our old grandfather never rested until all he had was made over into land and yet more land. But land is not so sure as it once was. There are even places where the tenants have arisen and taken land from landlords."
"Are they not stopped?" asked Yuan, astonished.
And the lady thrust in sharply, "They ought to be killed." But the cousin shrugged himself a little in the tightness of his foreign coat, and flung up his pudgy hands, and he said, "Who shall stop them? Who knows how to stop anything these days?" And when Yuan murmured,
"Government,"
he repeated, "Government? This new confusion of warlord and student and that we call government? What can they stop? No, each man for himself these days, and so the money pours into our banks, and we are safe enough, guarded by foreign soldiery and under foreign law. Yes, it is a good, prosperous place I hold, and I have it through the grace of friends." "My friends," his lady put in quickly. "If it had not been for me and that I grew friends with a great banker's wife, and through her came to know her husband, and begged for you." "Yes, yes," the man said hastily, "I know that." And he fell into silence and discomfort of a sort, as though there were something there he would not discuss too clearly, and as though he had paid some secret price for what he had. Then the lady asked Yuan very prettily, for there was a sort of cool, polished prettiness in all she said and did now, as though she had said and done everything before a mirror first. "So, Yuan, you are home again and a man, and you know everything." When Yuan smiled mutely to deny his knowledge, she laughed a little set laugh, and put her silken kerchief to her lips, and said again, "Oh, I am sure you know much you will not tell of, for you have not come out of such years knowing as little as you did when you began them." What Yuan would have said to this he did not know, and he felt uneasy, as though his cousin's wife was false and strange, and as though she were encased about with falseness, so he could not know how she really was. But at this moment a servant came in leading her old mistress, and Yuan rose to greet his aunt. Into this rich foreign room the old lady came, leaning on her servant. She was a thin, upright figure, her hair still black, but her face wrinkled into many crossing lines, though her eyes were as they were, very sharp and critical of all they saw. To her son and son's wife she paid no heed, but she let Yuan bow to her and took his greeting, and sat down and called to the servant, saying, "Fetch me the spittoon." When the servant had so done, she coughed and spat very decently, and then she said to Yuan, "I am as sound as ever I was, thanks to the gods, except that I have this cough, and the phlegm comes up in me especially in the mornings." At this her daughter-in-law looked at her with great distaste, but her son said soothingly, "It is always so with the aged, my mother." The lady paid no heed to him. She looked Yuan up and down and asked, "How does my second son in that outer country?" And when she heard Yuan say Sheng was well, she said positively, "I shall wed him when he comes home." Now her daughter-in-law laughed out and said uncautiously, "I do not see Sheng being wed against his will, my mother, not as the young are nowadays." The old lady cast a look at her daughter-in-law, a look which showed she had spoken her feelings against her many times, and now it was no use. So she said on to Yuan, "My third son is an official. Doubtless you have heard. Yes, Meng is now a captain over many men in the new army." This Yuan heard again, and again he smiled secretly, remembering how this lady had once cried against Meng. His cousin saw the smile and put down the bowl of tea he had been sipping loudly, and he said, "It is so. My brother came in with the triumphant armies from the south, and now he holds a very good high place in the new capital, and has his own soldiers under him, and we hear very brave and ruthless tales of him.
He could come any day now to see us, for he is safe enough since the old rulers are swept so clean and flown to every foreign land for safety. Only he is busy and cannot be spared." But the old lady would not suffer any talk but her own. She coughed and spat again loudly, and then she asked, "What position shall you take, Yuen, now that you have been abroad? You ought to win a very good high pay." To this Yuen answered mildly, "First, as you know, Ailan is to be wed 3 days hence, and then I go to my father, and then I shall see how the way opens up before me."
"That Ailan," said the old lady suddenly, fastening on the name,
"I would not let my daughter wed a man like that. I would put her in a nunnery first."
"Ailan in a nunnery?"
cried her son's wife, hearing this, and she laughed her little false and bitter laugh. "If she were my daughter, so I would," the old lady said firmly, staring at her daughter-in-law. And she would have said more, except that she choked suddenly, and she coughed until the servant must rub her shoulders and strike her back to let her breathe again. At last Yuen took his leave, and when he went homeward through the sunny streets, choosing to walk this fair day, he thought how good as dead this old pair were. Yes, all the old were as good as dead, he thought joyously. But he was young, and the times were young. And on this brilliant summer's morning it seemed to him he met none but young in this whole city. Young, laughing girls in light-colored robes, their pretty arms bare in the new foreign fashion, and young men with them, free and laughing. In this city all today were rich and young, and Yuen felt himself one of these rich and young. But his life was good to him. But soon none had time to think of anything these days except Ailan's wedding. For Ailan and the man were well known everywhere among the young rich of the city, not only of their own race, but among those of other peoples too. And they were bidden to the marriage more than 1,000 guests, and to the feast afterwards very nearly as many. Yuen had no time for any speech with Ailan alone, except for a little hour on the first day when he came back. Yet even then he felt he did not truly talk with her. For her old, teasing, laughing self was gone, and he could not penetrate into the lovely finish and assuredness that wrapped her about now. She asked him, with what seemed her old, frank look, "You are glad to be home, Yuen?" But when he answered, he saw that her eyes, for all they looked at him, did not see him at all, but were turned inward in some thought of her own, and they were only lovely shapes of dark, liquid light. So through all the hour, until Yuen was bewildered by the distance all about her, and he asked uneasily, blurting out the words,
"You are different. You do not seem happy. Do you want to marry?"
But there, the distance still was. She opened her pretty eyes very widely, and made her voice very cool and silvery, and laughed a small, clear laugh, and said,
"Am I not so pretty, Yuen? I have grown old and pale and ugly."
And when Yuen said hastily,
"No, no, you are prettier, but—"
And she said, mocking him a little as she used to do,
"What, shall I be so bold as to say I want to be wed and must be wed to this man? Did I ever do anything I did not want to do, brother? Have I not always been naughty and willful? At least I hear my aunt say so, and mother is too good to say it, but I know she thinks it."
But Yuen, although she made her eyes mischievous and arch in shape, and twisted her pretty brows above them, still saw her eyes were empty, and he said no more. Thereafter he spoke no more alone with her, for each night of those 3 days she went forth in a new dress, and wrapped about with silks of every hue. And even if Yuen was bidden with her as a guest, he saw her only in the distance, a lovely, brilliant figure, strange to him these days, engrossed in her own self, and seeing everyone as in a dream. She was silent as she had never been before, her laughter only smiles now, her eyes soft instead of bright, and all her body round and soft and gentle, moving slowly and with cool grace, instead of with her old, light, leaping merriment. She had cast aside the charm of her gay youth, and had learned this new charm of silence and of grace. By day she slept exhausted. Yuen and the mother and Mei Ling met and ate alone, and moved gently about the house, and all noise was shut out until nightfall, when again Ailan came forth to meet her love, and go forth with him to some house where they were bidden as guests. If she rose earlier, it was only that she might have fitted to her form, by the many tailors who came for this, the gowns of silk and satin that she wanted, and among them was the pale, peach-hued satin wedding gown, with its trailing, silvery foreign veil. Now Yuan noted how silent and how grave the mother was through the few days before the marriage. She spoke very little to anyone except to Mei Ling, and on her she seemed to lean for many things. She said, "Did you take the broth in to Ailan?" Or she said, "Ailan must have soup to drink or that dried foreign milk she likes when she comes in tonight. I thought her pale." Or she said, "Ailan wants two pearls to hold the veil, you know. Bid a jeweler send what he has for her to see." Her mind was full of all these many small things for Ailan, and Yuan knew it natural for a mother to be so, and he was glad she had this young girl to help her. Once when the mother was not there, and they two happened to be alone in the room and waiting for the meal to come, Yuan said to Mei Ling, not knowing what to say and feeling something must be said, "You are very helpful to my mother." The girl turned her honest look on him and said, "She saved me in my babyhood." Yuan answered, "Yes, I know." And he was surprised because there was no shame at all in the girl's eyes, such shame as she might have had to say she was a foundling, of what parents she did not know. And then Yuan, feeling her like one of his house, because of her feelings to his mother, said, "I wish she seemed happier to see my sister wed. Most mothers are glad, I thought, if their daughters wed." But to this Mei Ling answered nothing. She turned her head away, and at that moment the servant came in with bowls of meats, and she went forward herself to set them on the table. Yuan watched her do it, and she did it very simply, and not at all as though she shared a servant's task. He watched her, forgetting that he did so, and he saw how slight yet strong her lithe body was, how firm and quick were her hands, not making one useless movement. And he remembered how not once, when his mother asked if a thing were done or not, had it been undone. Chapter 22. Thus the days drew on quickly to Ailan's marriage day. It was to be a very great wedding, and to the largest and most fashionable hotel in the whole city the guests were bidden to come at an hour before noon. Since Ailan's father was not there, and since the old uncle could not stand so long, her elder cousin took his place, and beside her was her mother, who never left her at all. This marriage was according to a new fashion, and very different from the simple way in which her grandfather Wang Lung had taken his wives, and very different, too, from the old formal weddings of his sons and ways set and appointed by the forefathers. In these days the city people wed their sons and daughters in many ways, in some more old and in some more new. But be sure Ailan and her lover must have the very newest. Therefore there was much music from foreign instruments hired for the day, and there were flowers set everywhere, and these alone cost many hundreds of silver pieces. The guests came in all the various garb of their races, for Ailan and her lover counted such people among their friends. These all gathered in a vast hall of the hotel. Outside, the streets were choked with their vehicles, and with the idle and the poor who pressed to see what they could, and to try what they could do to gain something from the day, to beg or to slip their hands unseen into pockets of the throng and take what they found there, although guards had been hired to hold them back. Through this great throng, Yuan and the mother and Ailan rode, the driver incessantly sounding his horn lest some be crushed, and when the guards saw their vehicle and the bride within, they darted forward, shouting out, "Make way! Make way!" Through all this din, Ailan rode proudly, silent now, her head bent a little beneath the long veil held to her head by the two pearls and by a circle of small fragrant orange flowers. She held between her hands a great cluster of white lilies and small white roses, very fragrant. Never had there been so beautiful a creature. Even Yuan was awed by her beauty. A little cool, set smile hung on her lips, though she would not let it out, and her eyes glittered black and white beneath her lowered lids, for well she knew her own beauty, and there was not one whit of it she did not know, and had not fostered to its utmost height. The very crowd fell silent before her, and when she stepped out, its thousand eyes fastened on her hungrily, and drank in all her beauty, at first silently and then with restless murmurings.
Ah, see her!
Ah, how fair, how fair! Ah, never such a bride was seen! And be sure Ailon heard it all, but she made as if she did not. So, too, when she came into the great hall, when the music set the moment, did all the crowded guests turn their heads, and that same wondering silence came upon them. Yuen, who had gone first and stood with the man who was to wed her, saw her coming slowly between the guests, two little white-clad children before her scattering roses for her to tread upon, and maidens with her too, clad in silks of many hues, and he could not but share the wonder at her beauty. Yet even so, even at that moment, although he did not know it until afterward, he saw Mei Ling very clearly, for she was with Ailon as attendant. Yes, after all the wedding was over, and the contract read between the two, and when they had bowed to those who stood for the two families, and bowed to the guests and all to whom such courtesy was due, when all was over, the mighty feast and the merrymaking and the wedded pair were gone to have a holiday together. Then, thinking of it all upon his return to his home, Yuen remembered, and he was surprised he did, the girl Mei Ling. She had walked alone before Ailon, and even Ailon's radiance had not made Mei Ling seem unnoticeable. Now Yuen remembered very well she wore a soft, long robe of apple green, the sleeves cut very short, and the collar high, so that above the color her face looked clear and somewhat pale and resolute. The very difference to Ailon made her hold her own against such beauty. For Mei Ling's face owed nothing to its color, or to its changefulness, or sparkling eyes or smile, as Ailon's did. Its good, high look was from the perfect line of bone beneath the firm, clear flesh, a line which, Yuen thought, would keep its strength and nobleness long past its youth. She looked older now than her age was. But some day in her age, her straight, low nose, her clean, oval cheeks and chin, her sharp-cut lips, the straightness of her short black hair, shaped smoothly against her head, would give her youth again. Life could not greatly change her. Even as now a certain gravity was hers, so in her maturity she would still be young. Yuen remembered this gravity. Of all that wedding party, only two were grave, the mother and Mei Ling. Yes, even at the feast, when wines of every foreign sort were poured out, and all the tables full of guests were crying out such wit as they did not know they had before, when glass was lifted high to glass, and the bride and groom joined in the laughter as they made their way between the guests, even then Yuen saw at his table that the mother's face was grave, and so was Mei Ling's. These two talked together in low tones often, and directed the servants here and there, and took counsel with the master of the hotel. And Yuen thought they were grave because of all these cares, and he let it pass and looked about the brilliant hall. But that night, when they were alone after all was over, and the house was silent save for servants passing here and there to set covers right again and bring order everywhere, the lady sat in her chair so silent and downcast that Yuen felt he must say something to make her lift her heart up somehow. And so he said kindly, "Ailon was beautiful, the loveliest I ever saw, the loveliest woman." The lady answered listlessly, "Yes, she was beautiful. She has these 3 years been counted the most beautiful among the young rich ladies of the city, famous for her beauty." She sat a while, and then she said with strange bitterness, "Yes, and I wish it had not been so. It has been the curse of my own life and of my poor child's that she has been so beautiful. She has needed to do nothing. She has not needed to use her mind or hands or anything, only to let people look at her, and praise flowed in upon her, and desire and all that others work to gain.
Such beauty only a very great spirit can withstand, and Ailan is not great enough to bear it. At this, Mei Ling looked up from a piece of sewing she had in her hands, and cried softly and beseechingly,
"Mother."
But the lady would say on, as if for once her bitterness was more than she could bear, "I say only what is true, my child. Against this beauty have I fought my whole life, but I have lost. Yuan, you are my son, I can tell you. You wonder that I let her wed this man? So may you wonder, for I do not like or trust him, but it had to be. Ailan is with child by him." So simply did the lady say these dreadful words. Yuan, hearing them, felt the beating of his heart stop. He was yet young enough to feel the horror of this thing, that his own sister. He glanced in great shame at Mei Ling. Her head was bent over the bit of cloth she held, and she said nothing. Her face was not changed, only more grave and quiet. But the lady caught Yuan's glance and understood it. She said, "You need not mind, for Mei Ling knows everything. I could not have borne my life if I had not had her. She it was who helped me to plan and know what I must do. I had no one, Yuan, and she stayed a sister to my poor, pretty, foolish child, and that one leaned upon her too. She even would not let me send for you, Yuan. Once I thought I must have a son to help me, for I am not used in all these new ways of divorce, and I could not tell your eldest cousin even, not anything, for I was ashamed. But Mei Ling would not let me spoil your years abroad." Still Yuan could not say a word. His blood flushed up to his cheeks, and he sat confused and shamed, and angry too. And the lady, understanding very well this confusion, smiled sadly and said once more, "I dared not tell your father, Yuan, whose only simple remedy is killing. And even if he had not been so, I could not tell him. It is a sorry end to all my care for Ailan, to train and school my daughter in such freedom as this. Is this the new day, then? In the old days the two would have suffered death for such a sin, but now they will suffer nothing. They will come back and live merrily, and Ailan's child will come too soon, but none will whisper more loudly than behind their hands, because today many children come too soon. It is the new day." The lady smiled a mirthless smile, but there were tears in her eyes. Then Mei Ling folded up the bit of silk she sewed and thrust her needle in it, and came and said soothingly, "You are so tired, you do not know what you say. You have done everything for Ailan, and well she knows it, and so do we all. Come and sleep, and I will fetch a broth for you to drink." Then the lady rose obedient to the young girl as though it were a thing she had often done, and went out leaning on her shoulder gratefully. And Yuan watched the two go, still having nothing he could say, so confounded was he by what he had heard. So Ailan, his own sister, had done so wild a thing. Thus had she used her freedom. Into his own life through her had come again this hot, wild thing, which he had twice escaped. He went slowly to his own room, very troubled, and troubled in his old, divided way, as though nothing could ever come clearly and simply to him, neither love nor pain. For now half he was ashamed of Ailan's recklessness, because such things ought not to happen to his own sister, in whom he wanted to have nothing but whole pride, and yet half he was troubled because there was a hidden sweetness in this wild thing, and he wanted it for himself. It was the first doubtfulness to fall upon him in his own country. When this marriage day was over, Yuan knew he must not in decency delay his going to his father, and he was eager to be gone, and the more eager because he found it sad in this home now. The mother was more quiet even than she ever had been, and Mei Ling devoted her time steadfastly to her school. In the 2 days while Yuan made ready to go away, he scarcely saw the girl. Once he thought she avoided him, and then he said to himself, "It is because of what my mother said of Ailan. It is natural for a maid so modest to remember that." And he liked this modesty. Yet when the time came, when he must set forth and take the train north, he found he wanted to bid Mei Ling goodbye,
and not leave to be away the month or two and not see her again. He even waited, therefore, and chose a later train by night, so that he could see her come home from her school, could dine alone with the lady and with her, and talk a little quietly with them before he went. And as they talked, he found he listened for the girl's speech, very clear and soft and pleasant always, and not shy and giggling as the laughter of maids is sometimes. She seemed always busy at some bit of sewing, and once or twice when a servant came in to ask a question of the next day's meats or some such thing, Yuen heard her ask Mei Ling instead of the lady, and Mei Ling gave directions as though she had done it many times. Nor was she shy in speech. This night, since the lady was more quiet than usual, and Yuen silent too, Mei Ling talked on and told of what she did in school, and how she had long hoped to be a doctor. "My foster mother made me think of it at first," she said, and threw her quiet, beaming look upon the lady. "And now I like it very well. Only it has meant a long time to study, and a great cost, and this my foster mother has done for me, and I shall always care for her in return. Where I am, she shall be too. I want a hospital of my own one day in some city, a place for children and for women, and I want a garden in the center, and round it buildings full of beds and places for the sick. Not too large, not more than I could do, but all very clean and pretty." So this young woman planned out her wish, and in her earnestness she let her sewing lie, and her eyes began to beam and her lips to smile. And Yuen, watching her, his cigarette between his fingers, thought in surprise, "Why, this maid is fair enough." And he forgot to listen to her while he looked at her. Suddenly he felt he was not pleased, and when he looked into himself to see why it was, he found he did not like to hear this maid plan out a life alone for herself, and so sufficient that she needed no one else in it. It seemed, then, to him that women ought not to think it well to have no thought of marriage in their minds. But even as he was so thinking, he saw the lady's face. For the first time since the marriage day, her eyes were lit with interest, and she heard all the young girl said. And now she said warmly, "If I were not too old, I would myself do something in that hospital. It is a better day than mine was. It is a very good day when women are not forced to wed." This Yuen heard her say, and while he believed it, or would have said he did, still it made him feel a little strangely, too. Somehow he took it as a thing not to be gainsaid or questioned, that all women ought to wed, although it was not what a man could talk about with two women. Yet their eagerness for freedom left a little coolness in him, so that when he said farewell he felt less warmly than he thought he would, and bewildered in himself because he was hurt somewhere within him, but he did not know just where or how the hurt was. Long after he had lain himself down in the narrow berth of the train, he thought of this, and of the two women of his country, and of how they were, Ailan so free she made her mother sad, and yet the same mother rejoiced in all Mei Ling's great free plans for her life. Then Yuen thought with a little bitterness, "I doubt she can be so very free. She will find it hard to do all she plans, and she will want a husband and children some day, as all women do, doubtless." And he remembered the women he had known, how in any land they turned at least secretly to a man. Yet, when his memory searched Mei Ling's face and speech, he could not truly say he had ever seen one sign of that searching in her look or voice. And he wondered if there were some youth he dreamed about, and he remembered that in the school she went to there were young men too. Suddenly, as a wind blows out of a still summer's night, he was jealous of those youths he did not know. So jealous, he could not even smile at himself, or ask himself why he should care what Mei Ling dreamed. He planned soberly how he must hint to the lady that she ought to warn Mei Ling, and how she ought to guard the young woman better. And he took a heed for her he never had taken for any living soul. And never once did he think to ask why he did. So planning, as the train swayed and creaked beneath him, he fell into a troubled sleep at last. Chapter 23. There came much now to drive all these thoughts from Yuen's mind for a while. Since his return from the foreign country, he had lived only in the great coastal city. Not once had he seen any other thing than its wide streets, filled by day and night with vehicles of every sort, with motors and with public tramways, and with people warm and brightly dressed and busy each in his own way. If there were poor ones, the sweating rickshaw pullers, the lesser vendors, yet these in summer seemed not so piteous, and there were not the winter beggars, who had fled from flood or famine to try a life in city streets. Rather, the city seemed very gay to Yuen, a place measuring well beside any he had seen anywhere. And in it there was the comfort and the wealth of his cousin's new house, and the display of the marriage and all the shining wedding gifts. And as he left, the lady had pressed into his hand a thick, folded heap of paper, which he knew was money, and he took it easily, thinking that his father sent it to her for him. He had almost forgotten now that there were poor even in the world. His own house seemed so rich and easily fed. But when he woke in the train the next day and looked out of the window, it was not to see such a country as he thought was his. The train had stopped beside a certain mighty river, and there all must descend and cross in boats and take up their journey again on the other side. So Yuen did also, crowding with the others on an open, wide-bottomed ferry-boat, which still seemed not wide enough for all the people on it, so that Yuen, coming last, must stand upon the outside near the water. He remembered very well that he had crossed this river when he went south before, but then he did not see what he now saw. For now his eyes, long shaped to other sights, saw these things newly. He saw upon the river a very city of small boats, tightly packed together, from whence a stench rose that sickened him. This was the 8th month of the year, and though it was scarcely more than dawn, the day was thick with heat. There was no great light from the sun. The sky was dark and low with clouds, pressing down so that it seemed to cover the water and the land, and there was no least wind anywhere. In the dull, sluggish light, the people pushed their boats aside to make way for the ferry, and men scrambled out of little hatches, nearly naked, their faces sunk and sodden with the sleepless night of heat, and women screamed at crying children and scratched their tangled hair, and naked children wailed, hungry and unwashed. These crowded tiny boats held each its fill of men and women and many children, and from the very water where they lived and which they drank the stench arose of filth they had poured into it. Upon this, then, Yuen suddenly opened his eyes that morning. The picture lasted scarcely a moment and was gone, for the ferry boat swung clear of the little boats against the shore, into the cleanness of the middle of the river. And as suddenly Yuen was looking no more into sodden faces, but into the swift yellow water of the river. Then, almost before he could grasp the change, the ferry half turned against the current, and crept past a vast white-painted ship, rising as clean as a snowy peak against the gray sky. And Yuen and all the crowd looked up to see above them the prow of a foreign ship, and the hanging blue and red of a foreign flag. But when the ferry had crept through to the other side, there were also the black points of cannon, and these were foreign cannon. Then Yuen forgot the stench of the poor and their little crowded boats. He looked up and down the river as he went on, and upon its yellow breast he counted 7 of these great foreign ships of war, here in the heart of his country. He forgot all else for this moment as he counted them. An anger rose in him against these ships. Even as he stepped on shore, he could not but look back on them with hate and question why they were there. Yet they were there, white, immaculate, invincible. Out of those black cannon, aimed steadily at shore and shore, had more than once leaped fire and death upon the land. Yuen remembered very well that it was so. Staring at the ships, he forgot everything except that out of those cannon fire could come upon his people, and he muttered bitterly, "They have no right to be here. We ought to drive them out of all our waters." And remembering and in bitterness, he mounted into another train and took up his way again to his father. Now here was a strange thing that Yuen found in himself. So long as he could maintain his anger against these white ships and remember how they had fired on his people,
and so long as he could remember every evil thing whereby his people had been oppressed by other outer peoples. And these were many, for he had learned in school of evil treaties forced upon the emperors of old by armies sent to ravage and to plunder. And even in his lifetime had there been such things. And even in the great city while he had been away, young lads had been shot down by white guards for crying out their country's cause. So long as he could remember all these wrongs that day, he was happy enough and filled with a sort of fire, and he thought in all he did, while he ate and while he sat and looked out over the passing fields and villages, "I must do something for my country. Meng is right and better than I am. He is more true than I am because he is so single. I am too weak. I think them all good because of one good old teacher, or a woman clever with her tongue. I ought to be like Meng and hate them heartily, and so help my people by my strong hating. For only hate is strong enough to help us now." So he thought to himself, remembering the alien ships. But even as Yuan would have clung to this wish of his, he could not but feel himself grow cooler, and this coolness grew in little subtle ways. A great fat man sat on the seat across from him, so near that Yuan could not always keep his eyes away from his mighty bulk. As the day wore on to greater heat, the sun burning through the windless clouds upon the metal roof of the train, the air within grew burning too. And this man took off all his garments, save his little inner trousers, and there he sat in all his naked flesh, his breasts, his belly rolls of thick yellow oily flesh, and his very jowls hanging to his shoulders. And as if this were not enough, he coughed in spite of summer, and he made much of his cough and rumbled at it all he could, and spat his phlegm out so often, that stay where he would, Yuan could not avoid it always. So into his right anger for his country's sake crept his petulance against this man who was his countryman. At last a gloom came into Yuan. It was almost too hot for life in this shaking train, and he began to see what he did not want to see. For in the heat and weariness, the travelers were past caring for anything except how to live to the journey's end. Children wailed and dragged at their mothers' breasts, and at every station flies flew into open windows and settled on the sweating flesh, and on the spittle upon the floors, and on the food and on the children's faces. And Yuan, who never noticed a fly in his youth because flies were everywhere and why should they matter, now that he had been elsewhere and learned the death they carry, was in an agony of daintiness against them, and he could not bear to have one settle on his glass of tea, or on a bit of bread he bought from a vendor, or on the dish of rice and eggs he bought at noon from the servant in the train. Yet he could not but ask himself what use was all this hatred against the flies when he saw the blackness of the servant's hands, and the sticky grime upon the cloth with which the man wiped the dish before he poured the rice in. Then in his bitterness Yuan shouted at him, "Leave the dish unwiped, rather than touch it with such a rag as that." At this the man stared and grinned most amiably, and then at this moment, feeling how very great the heat was, he took the cloth and wiped his sweating face and hung it on his neck again where he carried it. Now Yuan indeed could scarcely bear to touch his food. He put down his spoon and cried out against the man, and he cried out against the flies and all the filth upon the floor. Then the man was outraged at such injustice, and he cried out for heaven to witness, and he said, "Here am I, one man, and I have only one man's work to do, and floors are not my work, and flies are not my work. And who can spend his life in summer to kill flies? I swear if all the people in this nation spent all their lives to kill the flies, they could not prevail against them, for flies are natural." Then, rid of his anger thus, the man burst out laughing very heartily, for he was of a good temper even under anger, and he went his way, laughing. But all the travelers, being so weary and ready to look at anything or listen anywhere, had listened to everything said, and they all took part against Yuan and with the servant, and some cried out, "It is true there is no end of flies. They come from none knows where, but they have their life to live too, doubtless." And one aged lady said, "Aye, and they have a right to it. As for me, I would not dare to take life even from a fly." And another said scornfully,
He is one of those students come back from abroad to try his little foreign notions on us.
At this, the large, fat man near Yuan, who had eaten mightily of rice and meats, and was now drinking tea very gravely, belching loudly as he drank, said suddenly, "So that is what he is. Here I have sat my whole day through staring at him to see what he was and making nothing of him." And he gazed on at Yuan in pleased wonder, now that he knew what he was, drinking as he stared and belching up his wind, until Yuan could not bear to see him, and looked steadfastly away into the flat, green country. He was too proud to answer, nor could he eat. He sat on looking out of the window hour after hour. Under the hot, cloudy sky, the country grew more poor, more flat with wastes of water as the train sped north. At every station the people looked to Yuan more wretched, more plagued with boils and sore eyes, and even though there was water everywhere, they were not washed, and many of the women had their feet bound, still in the old evil way he thought was gone. He looked at them, and he could not bear them. "These are my people," he said bitterly within himself at last, and he forgot the white foreign ships of war. Yet there was one more bitterness that he must bear. At the far end of the car sat a white man whom Yuan had not seen. Now he came past to descend from the train at a certain little mud-walled country town where he lived. And as he passed Yuan, he noted him and his young sad face, and he remembered how Yuan had cried out against the flies. And he said in his own tongue, meaning to be kind and seeing what Yuan was, "Don't be discouraged, friend. I fight against the flies, too, and shall keep on fighting." Yuan looked up suddenly at the foreign voice and words. There he saw a small, thin, white man, a little common-looking fellow in a gray cotton suit of clothes and a white sun helmet, and with a common face, not newly shaven, though the pale blue eyes were kind enough. And Yuan saw he was a foreign priest. He could not answer. This was the bitterest thing to bear, that here was a white man to see what he had seen and know what he had known this day. He turned away and would not answer. But from his seat he saw the man get off the train and trudge through the crowd and turn towards the mud-walled city. Then Yuan remembered that other white man who had said, "If you would live as I have lived." And Yuan asked himself accusingly, "Why did I never see all this before? I have seen nothing until now." Yet it was only the beginning of what Yuan must see. For when at last he stood before his father, Wang the Tiger, he saw him as he never knew he was. There the tiger stood, clinging to the doorpost of his hall, waiting for his son, and all his old strength was gone, even his old petulance, and there was only an old gray man, whose long white whiskers drooped down sparsely on his chin, and whose eyes were red and filmed with age and with too much wine drinking, so that until Yuan came near he could not see him, but must listen for his voice. Now Yuan had seen with wonder how weedy were the courts that he came through, and how few the soldiers were who stood about, a few ragged, idle fellows, and how the very guard at the gate had no gun, and let him come in as he would, and asked no questions, and gave no courteous greeting as he should to his general's son. But Yuan was not ready to see his father look so gaunt and thin. The old tiger stood there in an old robe of gray stuff, and it was even patched upon the elbows where his bones had worn through upon the arm of his chair, and on his feet were slippers of cloth and the heels turned under, and his sword was not in his hand now. Then Yuan cried out, "My father!" And the old man answered, trembling, "Is it really you, my son?" And they held each other's hands, and Yuan felt tears rush to his eyes to see his father's old face, the nose and mouth and dimmed eyes all somehow bigger than they used to be, and too big in the shrunken face. It seemed to Yuan, staring at the face, that this could not be his father, not the tiger whom he used to fear, whose frowns and black brows were once so terrible, whose sword was never far from his hand, even when he slept. Yet it was the tiger,
for when he knew it was Yuan, he called out, "Bring the wine." There was a slow stirring in the hair-lipped trusty man, himself aged now, but still his general's man, came forward, and he gave his greeting to his general's son, his crooked face beaming, and he poured out wine, while the father took the son's hand and led him in. Now did another show himself, and yet another whom Yuan had not seen before, or thought he had not. Two grave, little prosperous men, one old, one young. The elder was a small, shriveled man, dressed very neatly in an old fashion of long robe of dark gray, small-patterned silk, and on his upper body was a sleeved jacket of dull black silk, and on his head a little round silk cap, and on it a white cord button denoting mourning for some near relative. About his ankles, too, higher than the black velvet shoes he wore, his trousers were tied with bands of white cotton cloth. Above this somber garb his small old face peered out, smooth as though he still could not grow a beard, but very wrinkled, his eyes as shining sharp as a weasel's eyes are. The young man was like him, except his robe was dull blue, and he wore the mourning that a son wears for his dead mother, and his eyes were not sharp, but wistful as an ape's little hollow eyes are, when it looks at human men to whom it is akin, and yet not near enough to understand them or be understood. This was the other's son. Now as Yuan looked at them uncertainly, the elder said in his dried, high voice, "I am your second uncle, nephew. I have not seen you since you were a lad, I think. This is my eldest son, your cousin." At this Yuan gave surprised greeting to the two, not too gladly, because they were very strange to him in their staid, old-fashioned looks and ways. But still, he was courteous, and more courteous than the tiger, who paid no heed to them at all, but only sat now and stared joyfully at Yuan. And indeed Yuan was much moved by this childlike pleasure his father had in his return. The old tiger could not take his eyes from Yuan, and when he had stared a while he burst into silent laughter, and rose from his seat and went to Yuan and felt his arms and his strong shoulders, and laughed again and muttered, "Strong as I was at his age, I remember I had such arms, I could throw an 8-foot spear of iron and wield a great stone weight. In the south, under that old general, I used to do it of an evening to amuse my fellows. Stand up and let me see your thighs." Yuan stood up obediently, amused and patient, and the tiger turned to his brother and laughed aloud and cried in some of his old vigor, "You see this son of mine? I'll swear you have not seen one to match him out of all your four." Wang the merchant answered nothing to this, except he smiled his little forbearing smile. But the younger man said patiently and carefully, "I think my two younger brothers are as large, and my next brother is larger than I, since I am smallest of them all, although the eldest." And he blinked his mournful eyes at them as he made his report. Now Yuan, listening, asked curiously, "How are these other cousins of mine, and what do they do?" The son of Wang the merchant here looked at his father, but since that elder sat silent and wore the same small smile, he took courage and answered Yuan, "It is I who work to aid my father with his rents and grain shop. Once we all did it, but the times are very evil now in these parts. The tenants have grown so lordly that they will not pay the rents they should, and the grain, too, is harvested in lesser quantities. My elder brother is your father's, for my father gave him to my uncle. And my next brother, he would go out to see the world, and he went, and is in a shop in the south, an accountant, because he fingers the abacus very well, and he is prosperous, since much silver passes through his hands. My third brother is at home, and his family, and the youngest, he goes to school, for we have a school now in our town of a new sort, and we expect him to be wed as soon as it is decent, for my mother died a few months back." Then Yuan, remembered a great, blowsy, lively country woman he had seen in his uncle's house, the once his father took him there, and how she made merry always. And he wondered to think she must lie still and dead, while this little creeping man, his uncle, lived on and on, so little changed. He asked, How did it happen?
Then the son looked at his father, and they were both silent, until the tiger, hearing what was asked, answered, as if here were a thing which had to do with him.
How did it happen? Why, we have an enemy our family has, and now he is a little wandering robber chieftain in the hills about our old village. Once I took a city from him in the fairest way, by open guile and siege, but he has not forgiven me for it. I swear he settled near our lands on purpose, and he watched for my kin, I know. And this brother of mine is cautious, and found out this robber hated us, and he would not go himself to take his share of crops and taxes from the tenants, but he sent his wife, she being only a woman, and the robbers caught her on her homeward way, and robbed her and cut her head off, and rolled it down beside the road. I tell my brother, wait a few months now until I gather up my men again. I swear I'll search that robber out. I swear I'll...
The tiger's voice dragged in weakening wrath, and he put out his hand blindly, searching, and the old trusty man standing near put a wine bowl in it and said drowsily, as if from long habit,
"Quiet yourself, my general. Do not be angry, lest you grow ill."
And he shifted on his tired old feet, and yawned a little and stared happily at Yuan, admiring him. Now, though Wang the merchant had said nothing during all this tale, when Yuan looked at him to speak some courteous comfort, he was surprised to see his uncle's little old shining eyes were wet with tears. And still silent, the old man took the edge of first one sleeve and then the other, and carefully wiped each eye. And then, in his spare, stealthy fashion, he drew his dry old hand across his nose, and Yuan was so astonished he could not speak, to see this cold old man shed tears. The son saw it too, and with his small, wistful eyes upon his father, he said mournfully to Yuan,
"The servant who was with her said if she had been silent and more obedient to them, they would not have been so quick to kill. But she had a very swift, loud tongue, and all her life long she had used it as she liked, and she had a temper always quick to boil. And she shouted at the very first, 'Shall I give you my good silver, you sons of cursed